Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
For the tough crowd, the never-fail crowd pleaser.
We cut taxes for first-time homebuyers. We cut taxes for parents trying to care for their children. We cut taxes for 8 million Americans paying for college. I thought I'd get some applause on that one.
There he goes again, anticipating what Congress will do. Political people-pleasing in the State of the Union. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, January 28th, and The Takeaway is, who do you please in a State of the Union address? Do you play to the House, or do you talk to the rafters and speak to the American people? I can't figure it out.
Well, maybe you end up not pleasing anybody, actually.
That's the danger.
Let's get right to the
top. Democrats, I would remind you that we still have the largest majority in decades.
That would be the president interrupting me.
He was obviously
I guess
pleased,
if anyone but. Can, he can. In his first State of the Union address last night, President Obama told his party, it is time to get tough.
People are out of work. They're hurting. They need our help. And I want a jobs bill on my desk without delay.
And as for health care, the president asked Congress to press forward.
This is a complex issue. And the longer it was debated, the more skeptical people became. I take my share of the blame for not explaining it more clearly to the American people.
The president did not spell out a specific roadmap or timeline for passing health care reform.
For reaction to the president's address, we're covering it all morning, but we're joined now by Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Kathleen, good morning.
Good morning.
So break it down now. How much was the president talking to the American people, and how much was he talking to Congress? I say Congress 60%, American people 40%. What's your breakdown?
I think it's 62.32% American people and the rest to the headline writers and the various media, with the expectation that Congress's perception of that speech will be affected by the reaction of those two audiences.
Interesting. Yeah. So it's a bank shot off the headlines straight to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Stay with us, Kathleen. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Toyota is recalling another 1 million vehicles in the U.S. over problems with floor mats. This newest recall affects five models. It comes one day after Toyota said it was suspending U.S. sales of eight of its most popular models because of faulty accelerator pedals.
A summit on the future of Afghanistan is now underway in London, where countries are expected to set up a fund to help lure Taliban fighters back into Afghan society. I traveled to Washington, D.C. yesterday to speak with General David Petraeus, who said the jobs and the money are the carrot, but there's also a stick.
I mean, one inducement is that if you don't do this, you will still be an extremist in the eyes of ISAF and Afghan forces, and you're liable to be killed. You're in the crosshairs.
More of my interview with General Petraeus is available on our website, thetakeaway.org.
Howard Zinn, author of The People's History of the United States, died in California yesterday of a heart attack. He was 87 years old. Taking a look at the markets, world markets reacting to the president's State of the Union address. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,236. The S&P opens at 1,097 and the NASDAQ at 2221. Coming up, many Haitians are hoping to start over in Florida, but how do Floridians there feel about it? We're going to go live to Miami later in the hour.
And all this morning, we're looking for your reactions to the State of the Union address last night. Did the president say what you wanted to hear? Was it more of the same? And what were your takeaway moments?
Mike from Rhode Island. I watched the Political Academy Awards last night. More rhetoric, hyperbole, and quite frankly, we've heard it all before. So we're still in a mess.
Your assessment at 8778MYTAKE or post it at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we'll review the president's State of the Union with Kathleen Hall Jamieson. We're also going to talk with Republican Whip Eric Cantor for what he thought. That's in about a half hour. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. We are thrilled to be able to spend the next several minutes with Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, to really take a look at the rhetorical significance of this speech last night, what it means for the Obama presidency, what it means for the ability to actually make things that were promised or at least alluded to in that speech come true for the American people. First of all, thanks so much for being with us again, Kathleen.
You're welcome.
And it seems to me there's a lot of themes here, and let's start with this one. It seemed to me that one general theme was, hey, we have to get our act together. And he was speaking to Democrats in this first cut.
I campaigned on the promise of change. Change we can believe in, the slogan went. And right now I know there are many Americans who aren't sure if they still believe we can change or that I can deliver it. But remember this. I never suggested the change would be easy or that I could do it alone. Democracy in a nation of 300 million people can be noisy and messy and complicated. And when you try to do big things and make big changes, it stirs passions and controversy. That's just how it is.
Now, rhetorically, this seems to be some of the most interesting stuff that the president did last night. This soft voice kind of confiding with Congress and by implication the American people. What did you make of it?
The first thing a speaker has to do is to create the sense that he or she understands the audience and understands its anxieties, its fears, and in this case, that some of its expectations about this president have not yet been met. You can't argue that you have created some of the change and then will accomplish the rest until the audience grants you that first premise, and that's what he's doing. But he moves from there in that speech to argue that some of the things that have been accomplished, you've lost track of, audience. You've lost track of those tax cuts. You've lost track of help with home ownership. You've lost track of the fact that people are employed who otherwise might not be, but we still have a long way to go. He's trying to feature the benefits he's already accomplished, but a long way left to go.
In this style of speaking, does he run the risk of looking vulnerable, of looking like, hey, guys, come on, it's hard, but let's get it together?
He would run a greater risk if he looked as if he didn't realize that there was a problem. And in the process, what he needs to do, and I think he did, was to signal to key constituents that he understands their needs. He talked to the young about college loans. That reduces college students' anxieties somewhat. He talked to small business owners about tax relief, capital gains cuts relief. And in the next couple of days, he will be in a contest with the news media to feature, he will be trying to feature positive things that are happening and promises he will fulfill. News media will be focusing on what hasn't happened yet. Those visual images will either underscore the speech or will undercut it.
Here was a more traditional soundbite from Barack Obama last night, really talking about problem solving, but couching it in a way that you might have heard from Ronald Reagan or even a George W. Bush.
Well, I do not accept second place for the United States of America. As hard as it may be, as uncomfortable and contentious as the debates may become, it's time to get serious about fixing the problems that are hampering our growth.
So, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, how does he do there? I mean, that's a very traditional role for a president. And here you see the president going back and forth between this very soft-spoken, hey, I'm vulnerable, hey, we've got problems, to this very straight-ahead nationalistic appeal.
Now, ordinarily, you expect part of the State of the Union address to speak to the world community, because there is an eavesdropping community around the world. Sometimes it's very large. In this speech, it's quite different. He speaks to the U.S. community about its place in the world and argues that the U.S. will not retain its global competitiveness unless these problems are solved. That's an important argument, risky because the public expects to hear, we are the best and we will be forever, but necessary if you're going to argue for fundamental change.
All right. Here he's speaking directly to the Congress, and I'm wondering how this plays, do you think, to the American people? Listen to this. I'm sure you recall this in that moment.
The Democrats, I would remind you that we still have the largest majority in decades, and the people expect us to solve problems, not run for the hills. And if the Republican leadership is going to insist that 60 votes in the Senate are required to do any business at all in this town, a supermajority, then the responsibility to govern is now yours as well.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson, does he run the risk here of sounding like he's saying, not my fault?
Depends on what you hear the rest of the speech saying. If you hear the rest of the speech saying, jobs, important, we're going to deliver, health care still on the agenda, come on, folks, let's get it done, you won't hear that alternative interpretation. But again, if news features that and doesn't pull in that alternative part of the speech, remember, this is a very long speech, what you feature matters, then the alternative interpretation is going to be more dominant.
Finally, I thought he took a really extraordinary risk in this next speech, where he talked, and actually Celeste pointed this out earlier this morning, that the president didn't make a lot of promises like he has known to do much earlier in the administration, things like closing Gitmo, setting a deadline for that sort of thing. We didn't hear that kind of thing last night, except in a couple of places, and here's one of them.
We will have all of our combat troops out of Iraq by the end of this August. We will support the Iraqi government. We will support the Iraqi government as they hold elections, and we will continue to partner with the Iraqi people to promote regional peace and prosperity. But make no mistake, this war is ending, and all of our troops are coming home.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson, it seems to me, if that doesn't happen, he's incredibly vulnerable.
He's saying, I'm going to keep a key campaign promise. You can trust me. I keep my word.
And do you think he can deliver on that? Do you think it's a risk?
I think it's a risk because in any situation in which you are perceived to be at war or are at war, you've got vulnerabilities, and you may have changed circumstances on the ground and may, as a result, not be able to keep a promise.
All right, finally, just your assessment before we go of this speech.
Good speech, difficult circumstances, but this isn't a time in which words matter. Deeds are going to count. Let's see what happens.
All right. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. That's really kind of a consensus we're hearing this morning.
Actually, it is.
And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check the headlines.
As we've been discussing all morning, the president gave his first State of the Union speech last night, and he said that becoming president means being dedicated to making tough calls.
I wouldn't just do what was popular. I would do what was necessary.
We'll get some more details on his address later in the show, but in Haiti... Those are cheers as French rescuers pulled a teenage girl out alive from rubble in the capital 15 days after the original earthquake. The French ambassador to Haiti gave an update on her condition.
Generally speaking, she's in good shape, but she might be really heavily traumatized.
Still, food remains scarce for many survivors. One relief spokesperson said aid groups have divided the capital into zones to better organize food distribution.
In London, a summit on the future of Afghanistan is underway, and countries are expected to set up a fund to help lure Taliban fighters back into Afghan society. Yesterday in Washington, speaking with General David Petraeus, he said Taliban soldiers are surrendering their weapons.
We don't expect this at high levels anytime soon, but at the lower and mid levels, there are near daily, certainly weekly examples of individuals who come in and say, I've had it, and let me put it down.
More of my interview with General Petraeus is available on our website, thetakeaway.org. In the past half hour, Ford is reporting a $2.7 billion profit in 2009, first full-year profit since 2005. You can hear our interview with Ford CEO Alan Mulally at thetakeaway.org. Why was he so cagey with you?
I know. You'd think he'd be like cheering with his pom-poms.
Indeed. He probably is today.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first news takeout takes us back to the State of the Union address last night, where presidents typically are talking directly to Congress. But last night, Obama had a message for the Supreme Court.
With all due deference to separation of powers, last week the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections.
So, Todd Zwillick, did the Supreme Court have much of a reaction to the president seeming to criticize that decision?
There actually was a little bit of a reaction, which in itself was strange. It's rare for presidents ever in a State of the Union to directly criticize the court. Don't forget, in the room, members of the Supreme Court sit right up front, front and center, right in front of the president. And they usually sit stone-faced. Here the president took it right to the court on this campaign finance decision, and Justice Sam Alito was seen by reporters in the press gallery looking down on him. He kind of, his head snapped back and he winced his eyes and he said two times to himself, that's not true. That's just not true to what the president said. Sort of a, not quite a you lie moment, but certainly a you lie light, you know, challenging the veracity of the president while he's on the dais. To himself, though, he didn't yell it.
Well, is this a C-SPAN trivia question or is this a serious breaking of decorum?
I don't know about a serious breaking of decorum. It might be the former, John, and it's certainly a State of the Union watcher, court watcher moment. I have never seen a president criticize the court while the court sits there. There were six members of the court sitting in front of him last night. I've never seen anything like that. And as soon as, you know, you're reading the transcript, and as soon as the president starts to take it to the court like that, you're staring at the court to see their reactions. And they're like statues. They're like gargoyles, just no movement, no face. And it was like Justice Alito, in the end, couldn't help himself. And the dam broke, and he just sit his head back and said, not true, not true.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what the fallout, if there is any, from this. And we should remind people there's a key vote on Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve today. Right, Todd?
Test vote, yeah. Okay. He needs 60 today.
Thanks so much. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillig.
Let's move on to the auto industry with Paul Eisenstein. He's the publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Well, it's good to be with Ford today, right, as they posted their first profitable year since 2005.
Yeah, big numbers from them, and it reflects the fact that Ford just has momentum everywhere they go. Their quality's up. Their product reviews are up. They've brought their costs down, so they're in a very good shape.
But on the other side of that coin would be Toyota,
mm-hmm.
which is not so much rising as
Toyota
falling.
Toyota seems to be sinking pretty fast.
What these new recalls of five vehicles, yesterday they stopped production of eight of their most popular models. This is a recall of five other vehicles as well.
Well, they're recalling eight vehicles. They're closing five plants. They've stopped sales of eight vehicles, some of the most popular models, including the Camry and the RAV4 and the Tundra. And we're not clear exactly when they're going to put them back on sale or begin production again because of this problem with sticky accelerators, which complicates a recall that they had last October for supposedly carpets that can jam accelerators.
Yeah, well, we had red flags on this as early as 2004. What took so long?
That's the big question that everybody is asking. Why has Toyota taken this long? The recall last year happened shortly after a California trooper was killed in a fiery crash, got a lot of headlines, and the feds just continued to press them for more. And in fact, as you and I discussed barely a month ago, there's another possible problem occurring where the brakes on Toyota Priuses are under suspect.
Okay, we're going to have to keep our eye on Toyota. That's Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com.
Paul will be watching it, that's for sure.
Yes.
And driving all the cars. That's right,
yep.
Exactly. Louise Story, our finance reporter for the New York Times, has our last takeout this morning. We referred to Ben Bernanke's vote, whether he will be reconfirmed. It's expected he will be reconfirmed at the Fed. But the big announcement yesterday was kind of a relief for the markets. The Fed decides to leave interest rates where they are for the time being. Why is it a relief?
Well, you know, once you raise interest rates, the cost of borrowing throughout the entire economy go up. What the Fed sets is called the target federal funds rate, and it's been down near zero since December 2008. A lot of economists were expecting them to keep it where it was. Nonetheless, if they had increased it, you know, it would have been maybe hard in the housing market. And that's the thing to pay attention with the Fed right now is the Fed and housing, because whatever they do with interest rates will affect your mortgage rate or your possibility of buying a home. And the other thing the Fed has going on, and we've talked about it before, is this giant program where they have been buying mortgage bonds out of the market.
Right.
That has been pushing rates down on mortgages as well. They're still planning, they said yesterday, they're still planning to end that program at the end of March. And so that could drive mortgage rates up. And this is coming. I don't know if you saw, but yesterday also there was new housing data that showed in December we had drops in housing sales again. So this is coming while we're still in a pretty tentative, precarious place in the housing market.
Well, I know you always kind of break into a rash when I try to push you into speculative analytical zones, but are we seeing the Fed hamstrung here, kind of backed into a corner? They only have a lever that is negative. They don't have much leverage positively.
Well, there is not that much more they could do. They could extend this mortgage-backed security, this bond-buying program beyond March, but they have been telling us meeting after meeting they're not going to do that. You even had, you had one dissenter yesterday. You know, they have this whole group of people who vote on this, who vote on interest rates, and one person from the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank thinks they should go on and raise interest rates because he's concerned about inflation. But if the housing market stays down in the gutter where it looks like it's staying, I'm not sure what else the Fed will do. And so that is a conundrum for them. And if Ben Bernanke gets reconfirmed, housing will stay on his agenda.
Mm-hmm. And the other real trigger there is inflation. And so far, inflation, no
so
real
far,
bad news.
So far, seems okay.
All right, Louise Story, finance reporter for The New York Times. That's your last takeout. But all this morning, we're looking for what you thought of the president's State of the Union address. Give us your take. Did he say what you wanted to hear? More of the same? And where were your takeaway moments in the speech? Call us with yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it on thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we'll find out what Republican Eric Cantor thought of the speech. He's the House Republican whip. And he joins us in a few minutes. So, ouch. Ouch.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, you can bet that there is a strong opinion on the State of the Union speech from at least one man, Republican Whip Eric Cantor, and we will go to him to get his thoughts about the speech in just a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. In his first State of the Union address last night, President Obama reset his focus on the economy.
Jobs must be our number one focus in 2010, and that's why I'm calling for a new jobs bill tonight.
He says another way to jumpstart the economy is to control spending.
Families across the country are tightening their belts and making tough decisions. The federal government should do the same. Starting in 2011, we are prepared to freeze government spending for 3 years.
The president also called for cooperation from Congress on health care reform and on education.
At a summit in London this hour, world leaders are organizing a fund to help lure Taliban fighters back into Afghan society. The chief NATO military spokesman, Canadian General Eric Tremblay in Afghanistan, says getting thousands of Taliban commanders and foot soldiers to reintegrate is critical.
I think it would be a major game changer. It would completely disrupt the current set of operations.
U.S. Central Command Chief David Petraeus was asked yesterday if he would rule out talks with the Taliban leadership about full reconciliation.
You would not want to rule out. That's right. Yeah, I would, but I would not, again, expect to see something productive in that particular area in the next months or however long.
That's General David Petraeus. More of my interview with General David Petraeus is available on our website, thetakeaway.org.
President Obama delivered his State of the Union address yesterday. His speech comes in a time when his job approval rating is the most polarized for any first-year president, meaning there's a larger gap of opinions on his job performance between Democrats and Republicans than ever before. According to a Gallup poll, there's a 65 percentage point gap between the two sides of the aisles. For a Republican's reaction, we turn now to the House's minority whip, Republican Congressman from Virginia, Eric Cantor. Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask you actually about a video news release you posted to your website after the president spoke that you called the Democrat Disconnect, and you included footage from the president's State of the Union address. Here's a clip from it.
That's why I'm calling for a new jobs bill tonight.
Speaker Pelosi and most Democrats just don't get it. Here are the real results. 3.4 million jobs lost, a $1.4 trillion budget deficit, and an unemployment rate above 10%. The Democrat Disconnect, brought to you by Speaker Pelosi and the Democrats in Congress.
So, Minority Whip Eric Cantor, the numbers that you put in there as the real results are actually the same numbers that he used in his State of Union speech. So where's the disconnect?
Well, the disconnect is that this president has embarked upon an agenda that is heavy on Washington programs, heavy on more government spending, and frankly, very light on the things that small business owners and job creators need in order to get back in the game and start hiring people.
Okay, the president walked into to a job in which the former administration had left him with a very large deficit and had begun the series of bailouts that we saw continue into the beginning of his term. At which point did you feel that when President Bush left office that those bailouts were enough?
No, the point is, in the beginning of the president's term, almost a year ago, the president's priority was the stimulus bill. I think everybody said that we wanted to get America back to work, that we could see unemployment coming. The president said, this is the way to do it. We'll stave off job losses and make sure unemployment doesn't exceed 8%. Well, that was supposed to be what the stimulus bill produced, and we know now that the average in the country is nearly 10%. It's not good enough. So why would it be that we want to now pass another big Washington spending bill, his so-called jobs bill, when it is not about more Washington spending?
What is it about? How do you solve the jobs problem?
Well, right now what we have is a real climate of uncertainty in this country. You have the specter and the overhang of tax hikes coming at the end of this year. We ought to all agree and say, you know what, we shouldn't be raising taxes in times of high unemployment. We also have the need to stop the spending. The president called for a spending freeze, but he said that we're going to have a spending freeze you start next year. Well, you know what? If you look and see how much spending occurred this past year, the domestic discretionary non-defense budget went up 66%. Well, we can go ahead and rescind some of the money that was authorized and start doing what we say now rather than putting it off for tomorrow.
So you support the spending freeze, you just want him to start it earlier.
Well, I think that once he'll have finished this year, the spending will probably have gone up over 80% from 2 years ago. If that's the case, freezing at that level, that's not what small businesses and families are doing in this country. They're having to really tighten their belt and cut their budgets. That's what Washington should be doing.
Okay, so Republicans have acknowledged, and you yourself has acknowledged, that health care is a problem in the country. And the president in his speech said that the politics in Washington is holding up reform.
Here's what I ask Congress, though. Don't walk away from reform. Not now. Not when we are so close. Let us find a way to come together and finish the job for the American people.
That kind of sounds, Eric Cantor, that he's talking directly to you. What is your answer to him?
Listen, I'm all about coming together. The problem is the words are one thing. It is the actions that have been lacking. And, you know, we saw the people in Massachusetts speak out last week. We saw the people in my state in Virginia speak out in November, along with those in New Jersey. People are tired of the arrogance in Washington and the way business is conducted. They're tired of being told how to think. And frankly, the country has rejected the president's health care bill. So it is time for us to start over. It is time for us to effect real reform. And let's start by bringing down costs. We know that this bill that he has proposed will cost over $1 trillion. That's not how you reform health care.
You know, I have to ask, you know, you said that the people are tired of arrogance and tired of being told what to think, which is the same criticism we heard under the Republican Bush administration. And I'm wondering, how much do you personally take responsibility for Americans' lack of confidence in Washington over our skepticism and lack of faith in our politicians? Do you feel like this is a point in our history when you need to sit down with your colleagues and take personal responsibility for getting things accomplished without the polarizing politics?
Celeste, there's enough blame to go around for all of us. The reality here in Washington is there's one-party rule, and that's where the public has now become to awaken and see that that's not necessarily good for this country, because when we look at the agenda that's being proposed, the policies of this administration, whether it's a stimulus bill, whether it's cap-and-trade bill, whether it's the ballooning federal deficit, whether it's this health care bill, the agenda has been rejected by the people. So the president had an opportunity last night to demonstrate that he's listened, that he's learned, that we will now start in another direction, down a new path towards coming together and solving these problems according to what Americans want. I didn't hear a lot of that last night.
Okay, but let's tackle just one thing that you just mentioned, which is the ballooning deficit. And that ballooning deficit began under the rule of an administration of your party, and it's continued in the administration of the other party. So how do we get that fixed together?
In order to figure out how to stop spending, you just do it. And the president called for the creation of another commission to find out how you stop spending. You know, families and businesses can't do that. They don't have that luxury. Let's get down to business and reality here. We can't all work together.
Okay, Republican Whip Eric Cantor. He's a Republican congressman from Virginia. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, here's a question facing Florida residents right now.
In general, do you think that normal immigration laws should be waived in time of crisis like the Haitian earthquake, or should existing laws be fully enforced?
The answer would directly affect people in the Sunshine State. We're going to go to Miami for more on this story. It turns out it's split right down the middle in their opinion on this issue. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And once more, Apple head Steve Jobs strips for the audience.
We'd like to show it to you today for the first time. And we call it the iPad.
It's an old tactic, the Steve Jobs striptease, announcing a new gadget from Apple, the iPad. It's followed weeks and months of speculation and anticipation. And to explain what it actually is and what it might eventually be is Nick Bilton, the lead Bits blogger for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning.
So this is a sort of a rich media platform that's part computer, part iTouch, but it's not a phone and it's not a camera. First of all, how does it stack up to what the anticipation was and a lot of the industries that were really, really hoping that Apple would come up with a gadget that could help some of their content?
It's amazing how much anticipation there was and hype around this device, and I really don't know how anyone could have reached that anticipation. But the device, I think a lot of people are really interested in what it's going to be capable of doing as far as for the publishing industry and reader devices and books and so on.
Now, it has a memory of about 64 gigs if you buy the most expensive $700 model, 16 gigs for the cheaper $500, and it's got Wi-Fi built in. What do you see this doing straight out of the box? And I guess they're going to be available in a few months.
Well, I think that there's a few things it's going to do. I mean, one is that it's an e-reader, right? It competes with the e-reader market, the Kindles and so on of the world. But it also is everything that your iPhone does. It's got all the applications. You can surf the web. You can do email, different things like that. And it's going to be interesting to see which device people opt for, if they go for the less expensive version or the full-fledged model that essentially is going to replace their computer.
Now, if this is the success of this device, that there are millions and millions of them sold immediately, so it becomes a kind of communication network that scales up the ability of people to distribute content. I mean, movie makers would love people downloading movies to 70 million of these iPads, right?
Yeah, I think that the success is actually going to be the software. It was actually really interesting to see there was a video game demonstration yesterday during the announcements, and where you could use multiple fingers to open doors and throw grenades and things like that. And it was actually using this technology that Apple really has the market in. If people build really amazing software around that, I think that's going to be what's really going to be the game changer.
Who are the content partners that, out of the box, are going to be participating in this?
So the New York Times is one of them. They built an application for the device, and then there's a bunch of book publishers that are working with Apple. It's really clear that Apple is really trying to take over the e-book market, and they even mentioned the Kindle as a competitor now to this product.
Now, here's the low-grade question. How long does the battery last, and can you actually carry a spare?
The battery's 10 hours, but they've built this really interesting feature into it where its standby time is a month long. We'll see where that goes. And I'm sure people will build exterior products for it to add additions to the battery.
And what's your ability to upload from this? In other words, you can create content on this and send it?
Yeah, so if you with the web connection, you can send anywhere, and I think that certain people are talking about building interfaces where you can actually sync from your web applications. Also.
All right, the iPad future. We're in it now. Nick Bilton, the lead Bits blogger for The New York Times, talking about the latest Apple product.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Coming up, I'm John Huckabee here with Celeste Headlee. A look at Haiti and the situation with the relief effort with Wyclef Jean, who joins us in just a moment, and also the sensitive relationship between the state of Florida and people in Haiti who want to leave that country after the earthquake 2 weeks ago. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at just about 48 minutes after the hour. The big story, of course, the State of the Union address from President Obama, who said he had to bail out the banks, even though he didn't want to.
And if there's one thing that has unified Democrats and Republicans, and everybody in between, it's that we all hated the bank bailout. I hated it. I hated it. You hated it. It was about as popular as a root canal.
The president said he's determined to get the American people's money back and is going to impose new fees.
Now, I know Wall Street isn't keen on this idea, but if these firms can afford to hand out big bonuses again, they can afford a modest fee to pay back the taxpayers who rescued them in their time of need.
And that's the big story we're following in the headlines this morning.
We're now joined by by Wyclef Jean, a Haitian-American musician that we all know from the music that he produces. And also recently we know him because of his charitable organization, Yele Haiti, which has raised somewhere around $2 million for relief funds since the earthquake struck his native land. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. You know, I remember seeing footage of you in Haiti just days after the earthquake struck, and you seemed shell-shocked. And I'm wondering, and you are also distressed by the lack of organization and the chaos. Have you seen things improve?
I just was back there 2 days ago, and we still have a backup of supplies at the airport, you know. They have to be a quicker way for the aid to get to the people. Compared to the first time when I was there and there was bodies on the floors and we actually was picking up the bodies and bringing them to the cemetery, I would say we definitely saw less bodies in the city of Port-au-Prince.
You know, an Italian official said that criticized the United States for not doing enough. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton bounced back and said that, you know, the United States has been extremely generous in its aid. What do you think about the international response to the disaster in Haiti?
I think right now, you know, I keep saying that the U.S. can put up tents in 48 hours, you know, like basically a whole community. So what I would like to see is the U.S. and the international community find a way to get tents for these people. If you're watching the news right now, you see people are making tents out of plastic, out of paper, and it's going to rain any day now. And we're going to head to a phase two of this disaster.
I wanted to ask you now about your charitable organization, Yele Haiti. You've raised somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 million since the earthquake struck. And there have been critics who have been saying that there are more reputable charities to give to and that there's been questionable spending from your foundation. What's your response?
I responded on Oprah, in Oprah's show. And my response to that is, of course, Yele Haiti is, of course, one of the youngest NGOs. I think if we was a foundation, we would not have that scrutiny. I clearly said, have we made mistakes in the foundation? Yes. The years that the tax was supposed to be filed, when we caught that mistake, we filed the taxes and got a clean bill of health. That situation was clear. I myself is Wyclef Jean. Have never embarked in taking any form of donation personally for myself, for my charity. The attack basically came in because of how fast that we were raising money. But as you see, I'm still standing. Yele Haiti is even more stronger now than ever, and we're going to raise a whole lot of money for the country.
So tents, would you say the number one thing that Haiti needs right now is tents?
The number one thing that Haiti needs right now, Haiti needs water, Haiti needs food, Haiti needs medicine, and Haiti needs tents. Urgently, these things. And when we say need, meaning logistics, we need the logistics to get these things to the people, too.
An organized relief effort. Well, Thank you so much. Singer and producer Wyclef Jean joined us from New Jersey.
Thank you.
In other news about Haiti, many Haitians who, as you just heard Wyclef Jean refer to, have no home and not even a tent for shelter, are now looking to Florida and hoping to immigrate to the Sunshine State and leave their native country behind. And this is causing some issues and debate in Florida. Joining us now is Joshua Johnson, a reporter and host for WLRN Miami Herald News. Also with us is Jay Newton Small. She's a Washington correspondent for Time Magazine, and she recently returned from Haiti. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning.
Jay, you just returned from Haiti. When you were there, were you hearing from Haitians about their plans to leave the country and maybe go to Florida?
Yeah, in fact, I was at a food distribution point in Cité Soleil, which is one of the poorest neighborhoods of Port-au-Prince, and there were all these kids wearing Obama T-shirts, and so I asked them, "Oh, what do you think of Obama?" And they were all, and they started, you know, chanting Obama, and they said, "We'll soon be with him. You know, we're going to go next week. We're going to go take boats from Cap Haitien, which is sort of the northernmost launching point towards Florida, and we're all going to go to Florida, and we're all going to be Americans."
Okay, so Joshua, you actually, on your program from WLRN, you had a poll there that showed that Floridians are pretty much split down the middle, almost 50-50, every time they're asked a question about whether or not we should grant immigrant status to Haitians and whether or not we should allow them to flood into Florida.
Yeah, and I have to say, when I heard Jay say that just now, that made me wince, because the immigration policy has not changed toward Haitian emigres trying to arrive in an undocumented fashion. They're still going to be detained. But as to the poll, Quinnipiac University basically asked three questions related to whether the number of legal immigrants from Haiti currently allowed should be raised, should normal immigration laws be relaxed in time of a crisis, and they asked about temporary protected status, which will allow undocumented Haitians who were already in the U.S. when the earthquake struck to live and work openly. And Floridians are either almost exactly split or just slightly opposed to relaxing the restrictions any further, except in South Florida, where there's much more support for all three of those things.
Is that because there's a large Cuban population in South Florida? Do they perhaps have more empathy for the Haitian immigrants?
Maybe. Florida has a little bit of everything, quite frankly, in Latin America, and Florida has already dealt with mass exoduses before. I mean, there's already some talk, for people who remember Operation Pedro Pan back in the 60s, when Cuban parents sent their kids away to get away from Fidel Castro. There are some people who were talking about an Operation Pierre Pan, where Haitian children would be brought to South Florida. And even some Cubans who were Pedro Pan children are saying, well, I was sent away or brought to the U.S., and it changed my life. It gave me a chance. We've done it once before, so maybe we should do it again. But the rest of Florida doesn't have that experience like we have, so they probably don't see it the way that we do.
Jay, how does this debate play out in Haiti? Number one, are the Haitians aware that they may have to come here illegally? And number two, are they prepared to send their children away?
Well, first of all, and you'll have to excuse my voice. It's still a little raw from all of the concrete dust that I've been inhaling in Haiti, but there's a lot of Haitians who believe that they're somehow it's legal or whatever, but when you get up to Cap Haitien, it's pretty clear that, you know, you're going to be taking rickety boats, or, you know, it's not going to be a very safe trip, and it's a pretty perilous one. Not only that, they're all pretty well aware that there's, you know, a lot of Coast Guard cutters currently off the coast, so it's not exactly the best time to go. What NGOs are hoping is that instead of leaving the United States to go to Haiti, that they would actually leave Port-au-Prince and go into the countryside around Haiti, because that area is very underdeveloped, and they don't do a lot of farming there. Historically, 200 years ago, when Toussaint Louverture got independence for Haiti, it was all former slaves, and everyone turned away from the land. Nobody wanted to farm after that because of their slave heritage. What they're hoping is that they can rebuild the agricultural industry in Haiti and also rebuild towns that are outside a network of towns, internal trade, which would be much better than sort of having the one megapolis that Haiti used to be. It used to be this one enormous city, Port-au-Prince, which is now destroyed.
Well, what do you think, Jay? Does this desire to leave Haiti, does that show that they've lost hope in their country?
It's not that they've lost hope in their country. It's just that things are so desperate right now, and they just have nothing, no water, no food, and they really don't see any other option at all, which is really sad.
Okay, Jay Newton Small, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine, just returned from Haiti, and Joshua Johnson joined us. He's a reporter and host for WLRN Miami Herald News.
Soon to be in the Takeaway family down there at WLRN. For more of our Haiti coverage, it continues on our website, thetakeaway.org. Our Takeaway intern, Eleanor Miller, volunteered at a hospital. She's got a blog post there, and you can see it all at thetakeaway.org. And we're looking for your reactions to the president's State of the Union speech last night. Did he say what you wanted to hear? More of the same? What was on your checklist?
My name's Nora, and my takeaway moment was when he spoke to the college students about how if they take a role in public service, that their loans will be forgiven in 10 years.
Because in the United States of America, no one should go broke because they chose to go to college.
What connected for you? You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.